Introduce spin as a qubit, right? So we saw spin last class as a degree of freedom, which was a way of effectively introducing a phase shift. But we didn't actually do anything with the spin. It was just our handle for introducing a phase shift in one path. And of course, we saw that by introducing that phase shift, then we would lose the depth of interference in our detectors. So let's talk about spin as a qubit. And of course, the goal is important pieces. We want to get beyond a single spin, right? Single spin dynamics are fun, but they're not all that much fun. And we remember that a neutron is spin 1/2. And the gyromagnetic ratio of it is about half that of the proton. So gamma for the neutron is 2 pi times about 2,000 hertz per Gauss. The proton was 4,250. And so now we have a Hilbert space. That is spanned by path and spin, and the path degrees of freedom will, of course, will indicate as we have, and the spin degrees of freedom and I'll just take those as the eigenstates of the spin along the z direction. Okay, so they're plus 1/2 and minus 1/2. But less things to write that way. So of course we have a space of 4 eigenstates. So the experiment that I want to talk about is where we conditionally rotate the spin. So we have our spin coming, our neutron coming into the interferometer, and we'll place it in the spin up state. And we can do that by magnetically scattering it, or we can do it by absorbing the other spin states in a helium-3 detector. And we can do this really quite precisely. So our ability to put neutrons in only this path and not that path, well, that's really, really good. That's the background of the neutrons in the Hall. So that must be about 6 nines. This, we can get this to about 98% of the neutrons to be at one state. And so even though it's 98%, we'll keep a pure state dynamics for now and only go to a density matrix when we need to. So I'm going to put a spin flipper here. And the way that it's done traditionally is to adiabatically rotate the spin. And so what we do is we put the field in the guide Hall along the z-axis. And this field is small. It's of order 20 Gauss, just to give us a little bit of energy separation between the two states. And it's over a very large area. So you know that the Earth's field is 1/2 a Gauss. If I think about the energy it takes to create a field, it depends upon the volume of the field, of course. And so I don't want to try to make a huge field over a big volume. And there's no reason to. And then we make a device which is a wound coil that if I look at the field inside this box, so it's a little box, you can stick there. The field rotates through 180 degrees. So it rotates from being along plus C, so this is a Z component of the field, to being along minus C. And it really rotates. And so if I plotted the X component of it, it looks something like that. And, of course, the neutron has velocity. It's 2,000 meters per second. So it meanders through this thing. And we keep the adiabatic condition. And the adiabatic condition is pretty easy to calculate. You've all seen it in equations. But really what the adiabatic condition tells you is that the variation of this field, variation in the direction of the field, must be slow compared to the local Zeeman interaction. So you look at how fast the spins would precess or do precess and change your field slow compared to that. All right. So at the spin flipper is going, yeah.
Is there a sudden like onset of the field?
There isn't. We've got 20 Gauss here and we try to match these points to that. So if I was drawing the whole thing correctly, it would look like that. And then you worry about what happens here, and you should have to worry about that. You know, we say, we would like this to go down, but not rotate, right? So we want to keep that direction the same. Okay. So I guess the way I want to answer your question more correctly is that the non-commutivity is never big, right? Which is what you would care about. Okay, so now let's remind ourselves that this blade acts only on the path degrees of freedom, and so we can describe it. And there's no reason at this point to look at anything but an idealized blade. And so then, of course, it's going to create a coherent superposition over the path, and it's going to leave the spin state alone. And the mirror is going to do exactly the same. We'll put the phase flag here, and I'm going to draw it this way from now on, just to correspond to how we actually do it and what you would see if you were looking in the literature. We put a piece of silica for the phase flag over both beams, and it has a nice feature. I told you that 40 microns corresponds to a 2 pi rotation. And as I rotate this, of course, I can rotate a piece which is much thicker than 40 microns and have the path difference between those two be on the order of 40 microns. So the goal is to not have to make a device which is 40 microns thick. And of course also to not wrap the phase around many, many, many times.
Why is it a problem to wrap the phase?
You know, you just pick up more and more defects in your device. And so if you wrap it around many, many times, experimentally we find that it's not that robust. I don't know if you should say okay so quickly, right? Because, you know, if I have defects randomly on both sides, shouldn't that be just as bad? Yeah, that's right. So it is an experimental observation that this is more robust than trying to make a thin piece. But I've never used a thin piece myself. And I've never been satisfied with, you know, the simple answers of why this is better.
So you want the difference between the path lengths of both rooms and the cell?
Yeah, I'd like this to be, you know, small, so between 0 and 2 pi. And of course, you can see, though I didn't say it, that if the angle that the beam makes in this going through this part of the blade and this part of the blade are different, right? And so it's that's what's going to give us a difference in the path lengths. Now this, we're going to treat for now as acting only on the path. Of course, it's very easy to imagine we would put in a magnetic spin flipper, a magnetic phase here. And a big part of using neutron interferometry is, in fact, to look at the internal magnetic fields of materials. But for what we want to do today, it's just as convenient to have it only acting on 1 degree of freedom. You had a question?
I was just wondering if we go through the strip at a different angle on each side, then wouldn't we sort of be hitting like a different plane of atoms?
Thanks. It absolutely would. And this is silica, which is amorphous.
Okay.
And there's a lovely challenge in the field we're trying to answer is if it was crystalline and you imagined putting it inside one of these, then it's suggested that when you are on the Bragg angle, that the directly transmitted beam is tremendously slowed down. And so we would like to actually see if that's true. So as I mentioned, this dynamical diffraction theory is a little bit.
All right, I'm actually written down the spin flipper, the unitary spin flipper.
We haven't done that yet. We'll get there. And of course, this one, and then we'll worry about what we're doing over there. And just as you said, the. We need to think about the unitary, the spin flip, and it's useful to define two eigenpotents. Which are also the simple projectors if we're looking here. So these are the projectors. All right. So then if I look at my process, the gate for the spin flipper, so the action of the spin flipper is says, if I'm in one of the paths, then I should flip the spin. If I'm in the other path, leave the bloody thing alone. Okay? And you can, of course, also write this down via the Hamiltonian, right? So the Hamiltonian, you know, it's good to remind yourselves that a unitary needs to specify all outcomes. But the Hamiltonian is going to say, well, what's the generator of the dynamic, right? And so we could say, oh, well, I could rewrite this as a unitary in terms of a Hamiltonian. You know, it's the integrated Hamiltonian, of course, that looks like, that would be bad, that looks like that. And if you haven't seen it, to connect these two. Of course, if I take the exponential and I expand it, so then I have so this is an identity over the full space, right?
So this is going to be our unitary.
Yeah.
Why do we have to use this spatially varying magnetic field when we could just, I mean, I guess depending on what you're defining as X, Y, and Z, you might be able to just apply a VY field, but like you could, you know, replacing sigma Y, sigma X doesn't change too much. You just apply like a, you know, Zeeman split the X field in the X direction by like a certain amount. What advantage does this have?
Robustness.
Robustness.
And it's a good example of saying, you know, it's part of the encouraging of connecting to experiments that something that looks easy because I can say, oh, I just write down this little Hamiltonian, go in the lab and do it. There's different things that look easy. So if I take and I say, oh, I've got this background field of 20 Gauss, and I want to apply a Ravi drive to rotate between those, then 20 Gauss times the Drive magnetic ratio is giving us a splitting of only a few hundred kilohertz. It's actually a drag of a place to generate a large magnetic field. Mm-hmm. And when we do that, we'll end up having a coil with current going through it, so we'll heat the whole thing up, which will be a drag. It also will depend upon the time that the spin transverses that coil. Whereas here, within a wide range of momenta, we'll get the same result. So in fact, we'll use things similar to what you've suggested for other experiments. But for robustness, this is hard to beat. Okay, so just to remind you that an idempotent, of course, squares to itself, that the Paulis square to the identity, and that if I was going to take the next step of saying, oh, let me break this into sines and cosines so I can write down the expression that you're familiar with of looking at the exponentiation of a poly, that I need to break this term because the, you know, this term should go with the cosine. But it's not identity over the two systems, it's identity E plus. And you'll of course believe me that the sum of the two projectors is the identity state. And so once I've taken, extracted the E plus part of this, I'm left here with E minus, which is that piece of the term there. Yeah. So it's a nice way of looking at the action and of reminding us that, okay, we can write the Hamiltonian telling us the generators, but when we go and expand the unitary, we need to keep that part of the unitary, which is telling us that things aren't changing. All good. Okay, so now we've got this piece. We don't need this board anymore. So let's look at the state as we evolve under this. So we start off with the state coming in. It goes through the first blade. It goes through the spin flipper. And it's tempting to stop right there, right? Because now we have an entangled state inside our interferometer, okay? And so here we've generated entanglement. And we could simply take the rest of the experiment and say, well, that's effectively a measurement device that we're going to use to characterize the extent of the entanglement in this piece. Okay? Well, let's write down all the states, and then we'll come back and see. Now, of course, you know that I'm going to put the actual measurement operator over here. But of course, I can take any unitaries before that and stick them into that measurement operator, right? I can make a composite measurement operator as I like. Okay, just to be concrete, we've got the mirrors, so we'll change this state in a perfectly uninteresting way. And then we'll add a phase. And you might be tempted in this experiment to neglect the phase. This is really not going to do anything. But of course, that's more of the point that we want to see. That if we're going to look at entanglement, it's nice to be able to have some parameter to vary. And remember that if I make a single measurement in the neutron interferometer, it doesn't tell us very much, right? It's only the shape of the contrast curve that's going to tell us something useful. Okay, so finally, we put in the third blade, and so from the we'll get the term at this point, we're never going to be recombining these paths again. So now I can ask a different question. I can say, well, what is the wave function corresponding to the spin degree of freedom in each of these paths? So I can take the wave function over the whole interferometer, and I can just take a partial trace and look at it in each path. So let's look at what we would see in terms of the spin degree of freedom in path zero. And so there we're going to see one, we'll see the state. And notice that I keep these two pure. I've just chosen a normalization so that they're pure because I'm only going to explore the states post-selected anyways, so the normalization is whatever I want it to be. And all I care about here is to make sure that I've described the spin properties. Yeah.
Where did the minus sign come from? Minus in front of the EVI 5 there.
Came
from.
Yeah, but there's
the
second one. There's a sign.
Oh, should be minus here.
No, so I mean in the exponential, like the
e to
the
e
up and then
e to the e. No. That's just me being an idiot. Don't put up with that. Okay. Now, before we go and look a bit more, I want to remind you of what the spin state looks like. So let's take the phi equals zero state. Let's take the state at phi equals zero. And plot them on a Bloch sphere. And then we nicely find that in the zero path, the spin is pointed in this direction. And in the one path, the spin is anti-aligned. And so we get a nice pictorial piece of this entanglement. And what happens? So now that we need to say, oh, what measurement do you want to make in this system to show that you have created an entangled state and that you've created the correlations necessary. So think about the various properties of entanglement. And before I give you my answers, let me ask you to talk amongst yourself and to come up with at least a couple of properties of entanglement and tests that you could do. Okay? But I want to make sure everyone's thought about it before we start.
So the idea is we're going to repeat these. I guess what I would do is go through all the graphics. The idea is apparently what you can do is you can get graphite. Two sheets of graphite. They are good mirrors, but only when only at a very, very specific range of frequencies. So what you do is you put in like a say a spin. Have a B field in here.
In the graphite.
In between two sheets of graphite. And the idea was depending what our spin field is, then this thing will, if it's up, split it down. Now I can keep on the key field by the Z-mean splitting.
means that down gets reflected, but up doesn't. So we could do the same thing like here with spin x to detect if I keep ordering something.
And is the goal of these guys are the two paths coming out of there and then we re-interfere them?
So I guess what I'd do is I wouldn't re-interfere them or anything. What I would do is I would just have two of these things aligned the same. And what I want to see is I only get measurements on one of them. And then as I change phi, I think I'm what's the phi equals?
No, we'd have phi could be
I'm just seeing about what changing phi does. Changing phi rotates
By the way, just to be clear, this
fans thing?
It's only giving a purpose to one of them. Is that because it's intersecting the beams at different angles?
Yes.
Okay, let's continue. So there's a couple of general properties of an entangled state. And so if you were talking in general about entanglement, not this particular example, but you have two particles, what are the properties you would be looking for? Anyway. Yeah? You could do Bell measurements, but let's instead of immediately going to some jargon, let's try to say what are the properties that we're after.
Measure one property, you can know the value of the other.
Fantastic. So we would say that there's a correlation between outcomes on the two particles. Okay. So if I have two particles entangled, and that we would expect, or we would demand, that if we do a rotation of one of the qubits, it shouldn't vary the entanglement. The entanglement is preserved over, so the correlation that shows up because of entanglements is preserved over any rotation, any unitary, applied to one of the particles. So that's one property. And the other one The other property that I would think is that if you lose coherence on either of the particles, well, you're bloody dead, right? You lose it on the other. So now I heard you guys say already what I think is one of the nicer pieces here is that this term puts in a unitary on one qubit in the entangled state. And so what's our signature that by varying phi it doesn't change the entanglement? And I would like it in terms of that picture over there.
Varying phi just rotates the center.
So, and if you expand on what its is?
You mean rotates the spin?
It rotates these two vectors together, right? So that if I change phi, then I can change them, but they'll always be anti-aligned with each other. Okay? And so then let's say we wanted to show that. What do I need to make a measurement up here?
That graphite detector.
Okay.
That you described yesterday, and that allows you to do kind of a spin selective measurement. So you can do spin selective measurements on both beams, and you can watch this, and then just rotate your amorphous silica, and you should see, like, you know.
Okay. So now, good idea, bad piece of hardware. That graphite piece only works at 7 angstroms, and here we're at 2.2 angstrom. But if I, so we've got, we'll choose to make a, we're going to make a measurement in one of those two paths, right? And we want the measurement to be sensitive to spin. Yeah? But there's a trick here, right? Because if I take this state and I rotate it and I put my detector there, what am I going to see if I have a spin-dependent detector? So I'm going to measure spin up in the z-basis. So let's just think about the yellow one. We'll put the detector in the zero beam. If I have this state here, and I go and I send it to a detector which is measuring with measurement operator the eigenstates of z, so plus 1/2 and minus 1/2, what do I see in each of those two? 50-50, right? They say, look, we're measuring the wrong basis. So where do we want to be?
Right, so we want to do a rotor rotation.
So good. If we're going to leave that detector in, then we should put a 90-degree rotator to take this plane from being the XY plane to be the XZ plane or the YZ plane or any other one.
Is it easy to do that than just rotating the detector? Like, you can just rotate the detector.
You could take a detector, and you could take your helium-3 in the detector and polarize it along the x-axis instead of along the z-axis. So you can do that. You can do it with a super mirror and separate them. So there's a bunch of ways, but you've got it quite right. So, okay, what we wanted to do is I want to see that when I look in the two output beams, I'm going to see that there's a contrast which depends upon phi, depends in a nice way with the two beams along phi, and that we have this simple rotation. Now, let's talk a different question. If I said, so there you said, okay, yes, we recognize the correlation, we can test it. And I'm going to leave it to you to figure out the precision with which you could tell something about entanglement. Let's take the other piece and say, oh, I want to show that if I lose coherence in one degree of freedom, then I've lost coherence completely in the system. Okay? So you get to choose one. And let me choose that we lose the coherence in the spin. So how am I going to do that? Let's say I apply a magnetic field along the z-axis over the interferometer. Then remember that the neutron is coherently, the wave function of the neutron is spread over both of those paths. And the neutron is coherent in its spin degree of freedom. So now if I applied a field and the field was along the z direction, and I believed that I had a spin that was up in one path and down in the other path, well, it wouldn't do much. But of course, if I have the spin in a coherent superposition, then it's going to rotate, right? rotates in exactly the plane we've shown there. And if I make that field random, so I keep making a measurement with random instances of that field, then of course what I'll see is that I will decohere the spin degree of freedom. And as we change the phase, phi, we should see that we get 50-50 in both of our detectors, and it doesn't matter what we do. And we could do the same by decohering the path degree of freedom. I could simply vary phi, and I could integrate over it, right? So that I had effectively added or taken the average over all of those. And it's very easy to see that we would lose all of the spin contrast as well.
When we're talking about randomly changing phi, do you mean shot to shot? Or
yeah. Yeah, I mean, so it is, I haven't told you, but some people know, that the neutron beam is big. So it's 2 millimeters by 8 millimeters. And although we only ever have one neutron in the interferometer at a time, that it comes in at random locations. And so, you know, people can think, well, okay, over the area of the beam, I could vary the phase by putting in a prism or some other shape to vary the phase over that. However you do it, it's always going to end up being an average over a set of events. And so if the field is varying between instances, or if the field is stationary and is varying over location, it's the same averaging. What you don't want to do, and we'll talk about this later on, is to say, oh, let me put a field here, and I'll vary it. And I know that it takes 10 microseconds for the spin to get through. And let me vary the field so fast that it's going to take on many, many values over that 10 microseconds. And then, of course, the angle of nutation you see becomes smaller as the rate of change of the field becomes bigger, right? And so you can effectively have a field which, if it was static, would decohere the spins. But because you've applied it so quickly, the spins never actually had time to move. Yeah? So did I butcher your question? Good.
Butcher?
Yes. Okay. Now,
I don't know why you're putting so much effort in decohering the system. I just give it to a bunch of undergrads and say,
hey,
break the table.
Come on. I could give it to a bunch of theorists. I don't need to give it to undergraduates. Having gone this far, it's nice to take a moment and say, can we show spinner dynamics? And so you'll recall that, of course, if I look at a unitary, that I need to rotate through 2 pi to get back to minus 1 and rotate through 4 pi to get back to 1. But if I'm thinking about a single spin, well, okay, that's a global phase, and so we don't see the difference between a 2 pi and 4 pi rotation. But if I stick it inside, then I do see the difference between those two. And so we can say, oh, well, let's take this piece, which I've lost now, it's here somewhere. And instead of having that be pi over 2, let's make it some angle and then look at what happens to the state. Oops. And because I want to get to another subject, I'm not going to write down the math for you, though it's trivial enough to write it down yourself.
Can we do that just by adjusting the strength of the magnetic field?
So we could, here we can't, right? Because this is an adiabatic process.
Right.
We need to go back to your suggestion of putting a Rabi field there, and then we can. So I go through exactly the same math that I plotted there. And what I show here, and the notebooks from this year are sort of out of order of when I wrote them some years ago. But this is in the what I called lecture 6. And so I'm plotting the contrast in the zero beam for a detector, which is measuring spin up in this case. Okay, because I'm trying to look at the precession, the nutation, in fact. And so the vertical axis goes from 0 to 1, which simply tells us the probability of detecting. Here we have the phase flag, which goes from 0 to 2 pi. And so we see the rotation as we'd expect. And here we have the spin rotation, which goes from 0 to 4 pi. And clearly shows that you get this 4 pi periodicity in the, yeah.
Does some of those lines look a bit bumpy? Is that, that's just that, like, yeah. Artifacts in the system.
That's just the way I've plotted it. Yeah. No. I promise you that quantum mechanics is linear and continuous. Okay?
Yeah.
I know, but you know, go prove me wrong. Okay. So now then, let's stop that. So I want to talk about my suggestion for your tutorial today. And before I do, I need to introduce one trivial piece of physics, which we're going to use later on. But I'll just introduce it here. Neutrons, like light and anything else, have an index of refraction. So if I send them through a prism, then Snell's law still applies. The index of refraction is small, but is easily measurable, is easily observed. And so I can offset the beam. I'm going to offset it in a direction that's given by z. And the amount that I offset, of course, depends upon the difference in the index between these and air. We're going to use silica. And the piece that's important to me is the offset depends upon that separation. So by varying that separation, I can move the beam as I like.
It also depends on the angle of the prism.
It is, yeah, but that's the drag to change. It's actually, we build devices to change that. But here, it's much easier just to experimentally move two prisms apart. Now, neutron interferometry is a good way of measuring the effect of gravity. So, you know, neutron interferometry is very, very sensitive. And the neutron is a particle with mass. And so we can see the change in potential of a neutron as we change its height. And the way the experiments were originally done by Overhauser and Sam Warner is to take the interferometer and to physically rotate it. But it's a very delicate apparatus. When you physically rotate it, you introduce strain in the crystal. And so you see a phase shift even if there wasn't gravity. But of course, in the lab, we don't have an easy way of turning on and off gravity to see that. So I want you to look at a new version of the experiment. So that would be the side view of the interferometer. And we're usually looking at the top views of the interferometer. And so I'm going to put the prisms here. But I'm going to arrange them so that they raise the beam up. So they're rotated 90 degrees. And so if I have the beam coming into the interferometer, then in one path, it's going to be raised. And in the other path, it's going to stay where it was.
Are you going to recombine
them? I'm not going to recombine them. What I'm going to do is I'm going to choose that the momentum is known so precisely that they're plane waves. And so that regardless of the displacement, the overlap is perfect. Now, there'll be a phase rotation because of that. So as I displace them, I'll see a periodic phase introduced. But, you know, clearly, if I have two plane waves, I can overlap them any way I want and still interfere them. And if I want to describe it as plane waves, then I had better choose the momentum very well. And in practice, we can choose the momentum so well that we can separate these by microns. We're trying to do it to separate by millimeters. It's not hard to recombine them, but I don't want to add more complexity to the experiment today. Okay, so now then, and of course, we're going to put a phase flag here. So the first part is relatively simple. It says, show me that you can use this interferometer to detect the influence of gravitation. And tell me, you know G, you know the neutron mass. Tell me how big a potential difference you get, what you would see for a phase shift, and what the important characteristics, what's the important parameters if you were designing this experiment. And then here, this piece. Okay, you do that, you know, Sam and Overhauser got a nice paper in PRL, but it was sometime last century, and you repeat the experiment with this new idea, you get another PRL, but you might want to have a bit more impact, because, in fact, G is known pretty well, and the neutron mass is known pretty well. Let me write down the question as I wrote it down before. So there's a nice question, which we don't know the answer to. So since gravity and spin, you can both associate with an acceleration, then there is allowed to have an influence of gravity on spin. And that's not been measured. There's a few bounds that have been placed on it. So take this experiment, take that experiment, and show me that you can propose an experiment that would test the precision to which gravity is different for a neutron in spin up and a neutron in the spin down state. Okay? And then tell me what would be important for doing this experiment. And one key that I'm going to not let you get away with is you don't get to assume that where you're making a measurement, the magnetic field is zero. Because in fact, to make a magnetic field at zero over a large area is really, really hard. Okay? So you have to say, you have some background field. You still want to see this. And try to tell me.
So what you mean, we've got a background field on the entire device.
Yeah, there always is a background field. So, you know, you're not put, you could put it there if you want.
Right.
But just, you know, you expect that if I simply said, I'm going to vary the spin state and look at a change in potential, that there would already be a change in potential because you had a background field. You are allowed to assume that the background field is uniform. Okay? And so go and think about how you would make a measurement, what's important, and since we're trying to make a measurement of some small effect, think about what you would have to control, what the dimensions would have to be in order to be able to make that measurement over a useful range. Yeah? Okay. So then you have your tutorial. Any questions? Good, let me stop here.